There's a young lawyer and an old lawyer. And the young lawyer is asking the old lawyer for advice about how to argue his cases in court. And so he says to the old lawyer, well, what do I do when the law is against my client? And the old lawyer smiles and says, of course, then you argue the facts. And so the young lawyer says, well, what do I do when the facts are against my client? And the old lawyer smiles and says, well, of course, then you argue the law. And then the young lawyer says, well, what do I do when both the law and the facts are against my client? And the old lawyer pauses for a moment and says, well, of course, then you argue a human rights point. And that might give you a little bit of a flavour of the issue we're going to consider tonight. Human rights, are they a problem or are they a solution? The world has watched in agony as the situations in Egypt and Syria have spiralled out of control. Pictures of Syrian children dying from sarin gas poisoning were some of the most harrowing I've seen on live TV. How can such things happen? What drives a leader to order such an attack? How can armed forces, disciplined, trained soldiers, bring themselves to carry it out? Sadly, such massacres are not unknown. Within the last 100 years, we've seen genocides in Rwanda and Turkey, the Holocaust perpetrated by Nazis, and the barbarities which accompanied the war as Yugoslavia disintegrated. The essential step that you have to take before you commit such atrocities is to convince yourself that your victims are not human beings, or at least that they're not human beings who count. Even within our own country, some of the dreadful stories we've seen recently of parents starving their children to death or neglecting them, and we ask, how could a parent do that? And yet somehow these parents have persuaded themselves that baby P wasn't really a human being, and so they didn't treat him as one. Now, there's no doubt that those horrifying situations demand a response. The question for us this afternoon is not the agonizing question, should such a response be military? But rather the question, is the language of human rights a helpful way of thinking about the crisis in Syria and other less pressing issues in the world and here in the UK? Are human rights part of the solution to injustice, or have they become part of the problem? Well, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about human rights in origin. So let's begin with human rights as a solution. Historically, religious differences were one of the main factors that could lead human beings to regard one another as less than human. You see, if you're convinced your enemy is going to be punished eternally in hell, one possible response is to conclude that you're doing him a favour if you force him to recant. Or perhaps that you're doing God a favour if you're hastening your enemy's arrival in the afterlife and therefore preventing your enemy from affecting others with his false beliefs. Now, in the Middle Ages, it was at the edges of Europe where Islam and Christianity clashed, or in southern France where the Cathars rejected the Catholic faith, that these religious differences could be the cause of inhumanity. But once Martin Luther, with his 95 Theses, kick-starts the Reformation, the question of religious difference becomes a live one across Europe as a whole. The result is named by historians the Wars of Religion. Eventually, secular rulers realized that far from it being necessary for a nation's peace that all citizens should be obliged to follow outwardly a particular version of Christianity, it was better instead if citizens of a nation were given liberty to worship the Christian God in the way they thought best. And so the first human right to be established was the right to freedom of religion and freedom of conscience. Just ask any American. You see, today, Americans are far more aware than Europeans that freedom of religion is the first freedom, because it is, of course, one of the freedoms established in the First Amendment to the US Constitution. It's the first right recognized historically, and it is still today key to the freedoms which all of us enjoy. Because the right to freedom of religion is also the right to be free from religion. It's the right to be an atheist as much as it is the right to be a Christian. It's the right to be a Muslim or to be agnostic. It's the right not to have to attend church or Friday prayers. And actually, if you look around the world, those countries which don't have freedom of religion tend also to have very few of the other freedoms we treasure as well. Freedom of religion in some indefinable way seems to go hand in hand with freedom of the press and freedom of speech, freedom of association, freedom to be involved in politics. Now, the wars of religion which give rise to this idea of the right to believe what you want also give rise to international law as we know it today. Now, the credit's given to a Dutchman, Hugo Grotius, though his genius is probably as much his ignorance some of his ideas have been thought of before as it was his originality. Now, Grotius writes in a context of fierce theological disputes. There are disputes between Catholics and Protestants, and in Holland there are disputes between the Protestants themselves, as the Arminians argue with the Calvinists. And so Grotius is dealing with the question, what do you do? How do you persuade these people who are prepared to go to war over their particular understanding of Christianity that when they do so, they must never forget that the people with whom they're at war are also human beings? And he makes his case in his great book on war and peace in two ways. He spells out what Christians should never have forgotten, that Genesis chapter 1 tells us that God made human beings, male and female, in his image. Full stop, or as the Americans would say, period. Before going on, and by the way, the only ones who continue to bear that image are those who believe like you. That's not there in the text. And he explains why the God of Christianity requires the followers of Jesus Christ to behave humanely towards their enemies. And then he says, but even if God did not exist, the same duty would still apply. And so he says, even if you don't accept my theological arguments for why you should treat other people decently, even when you're at war with them, there are sound philosophical reasons for coming to the same conclusion. Human beings have a natural right to be treated humanely, even when our disagreements are so severe that we are at war with one another. And so that's the first thing we see. We see human rights developing as a solution to religious disagreement. The second thing human rights then became was a solution to identifying common values without reference to God. You see, during the wars of religion, the ostensible problem was that we disagreed about who God was and what God required, though there was obviously a whole load of power politics going on behind the wars as well. But when the dust settled, the majority of France's Protestant population, which at one stage had been 40% of the French population, they left. They emigrated to Canada. They emigrated to Britain. If you go to places in London where I live, Merton just down the road, they had the Huguenot weavers. Wandsworth just up the road has Hugo cemeteries that are there. You can find them in various places in the city as well. They went to South Africa or elsewhere, leaving the Catholic Church to reassert its control over French life. And so during the 18th century, you see three powers, the aristocracy, the monarchy, and the Catholic Church, seen as the forces oppressing the peasants. And so when the French Revolution erupted, that wonderful revolution which gave us Les Misérables, it comes with its Déclaration des droits de l'homme, complete with the slogan, ni Dieu ni maître, neither God nor master. And so the rights of man, notez bien, man, the rights of man were asserted by the French Revolution as a self-standing creed which had no need of God. So if human rights were initially posited as a solution to our disagreements about who God was, they're now offered as a means of arriving at common values without reference to God at all. And so the French Revolution gives us a vision of human rights as some kind of freestanding, self-supporting system of beliefs and values. Jean-Marc Beautreau calls it a religion without God. Where the Human Rights Act was adopted in 1998 in the UK, Francesca Clug published an influential book entitled Values for a Godless Age. Because we no longer believe in God, or because we no longer take our belief in God seriously, human rights operate, like Alain de Botton's Ten Commandments for Atheists, as a substitute for religious sources of values and morality. But there's a third problem to which human rights are a solution. Human rights are a solution to holding governments to account. The French Revolution and the American Revolution were 6 years apart, but they had very different characters. The American Revolution was heavily influenced by the experience of the English Civil War, a little local difficulty with which Cambridge had much to do. And also the American Revolution was influenced by the philosophy of John Locke, who set out in his work the philosophical underpinning for the settlement of the Glorious Revolution of 1688. To put it in slogan terms, Locke defeated the idea of the divine right of kings with the idea of the natural rights of men. Locke's theory of natural rights was built around his idea of property, which for him meant that property which men have in their persons as well as their goods. And so what Locke gives us is not human rights in its modern form. He gives us the theory of natural rights, which serves the interest of a property-owning male elite bound to the state by the social contract. If you want to put it this way, this is human rights for rich men. But it is, for all its limitations, a theory which seeks to use rights to limit the power of government. The key problem for Locke is tyranny, and human rights are the solvent that he's going to use to dissolve tyranny. Now, for all sorts of reasons, which we don't have time to go into, in 19th century Europe, the problem of them and us rears its head again. The problem of who are the human beings who don't really count. Pogroms in Russia and in the Ukraine led to an influx of Jewish refugees into Vienna. Mass migration of people out into Vienna. The mind of an aspiring young artist, one Adolf Hitler, is poisoned by a combination of experiences. And when he rises to power and becomes the Führer of Germany, the elimination of those who were subhuman is the key to his political program. It starts with the Jews, the Gypsies, and the homosexuals. And had he succeeded in the Second World War, the next part of the plan was to enslave, sterilize, and ultimately eliminate a further 60 million Slavs. Oh, make no mistake, Hitler hated the Jews, but they weren't the only people on his hit list. And when the death camps were discovered and the concentration camps were liberated, the victorious Allied powers faced the question, how do we ensure that these evils are never perpetrated again? In the aftermath of World War II, therefore, Churchill and others felt that it was necessary to establish a code of minimum standards to get as many states in Europe and in the world to sign up in order to guarantee that the horrors of Auschwitz would never happen again. I visited Auschwitz for the first time in May this year. What struck me in particular was just how systematic the approach to dehumanization was. Absolutely everything was done, from the minute they cut the hair of the people who arrived, to demonstrate that these inhabitants of the camp were not human beings. Now, documents like the UN Declaration of Human Rights set out an account of what is due to human beings. based on the objective characteristics of human nature, which everyone can agree had been so egregiously violated by the Nazis and the fascist and their fascist allies. Now, given that bloody history, how could anyone think that human rights were anything other than good? To raise questions about human rights would be even worse than suggesting that maybe unemployment might be good for you, or not getting an education. So you're all expecting the lecture to take a turn at this point. And you'll all be familiar, I'm sure, with the debating trick of attributing to your opponents a position they do not in fact hold. It's one many barristers have lived by for many years. But let me not do that. Let me take my definition of rights from H.L.A. Hart, the greatest legal philosopher of the 20th century, and I say that with all due deference to the recently deceased Ronald Dworkin. In 1955, Hart wrote an essay which addressed the question, are there any natural rights? And in that essay, this is what he says. Rights are typically conceived of as possessed or owned by or belonging to individuals. And these expressions reflect the conception of moral rules as not only prescribing conduct, but as forming a kind of moral property of individuals to which they as individuals are entitled. Only when rules are conceived in this way can we speak of rights and wrongs as well as right and wrong actions. Rights, according to Hart, are usually thought of as things which belong to people. Now, if that's how we view rights in general, it'll necessarily be how we view human rights in particular. Joan Lockwood O'Donovan says, this vision of rights is doomed, fatally flawed, because of its possessive individualism. We conceive our rights in this way. We come to think of ourselves as autonomous, unencumbered individuals whose primary self-expression is through the exertion of power over things which belong to us. And this results in a litigious and conflict-riven society. Now, there are three related criticisms in there, and let me unpack them for you. So the first one, the problem of individualism, runs like this. The result of thinking of rights as things which belong to me is that people come to see themselves as individuals, with the right to be free from pressure from other people, externally imposed obligations, and natural limitations. So instead of understanding our life's significance and meaning in terms of our relationships with others, we're encouraged to validate ourselves by asserting our independence from others. Prepositions are doing a lot of work there. We use our rights to force others to make rooms for our whims and our will. This leads, claims O'Donovan, to rights being asserted as demands, as claims by individuals to the detriment of wider society. The logical conclusion is you get an arms race of rights, where we all claim more and more rights to more and more things until eventually everybody is claiming a right to everything which should be a possible object of human desire and possession. The individualism inherent in our conception of rights then makes them a runaway train without any brakes. And what gets squeezed out, not just are those individuals who can't shout as loud, but also those common goods, those shared goods of community, which are no longer counted in an equation where the only thing that matters are individual rights claims. So that's the first point she identifies. The second, the problem of possessiveness. The basic idea behind rights is the idea of property. That was certainly central to Locke's theory of natural rights. He defined property as that property which men have in their persons as well as their goods. So when we think of rights as things which belong to us, our rights are like our possessions and our bodies, pieces of property over which we have an absolute right of ownership. English land law doesn't help us to think of rights of ownership in any way other than absolute, I think, probably. Now, what Lockwood O'Donovan is saying is that human rights are always conceived of as rights of ownership. Ownership over things in creation and ownership of one's own acts. The Scottish sceptic and atheist philosopher David Hume held that individuals' property rights were absolute, even in the face of desperate human need, such as starvation. Now, one doesn't need to resort to such a reductio ad absurdum in order to acknowledge that human rights conceived of as things which belong to me lead to consequences which are unsustainable. There have to be limits to what we do with our bodies and the things that we own. Our rights cannot be absolute, but must be balanced against the needs and interests of others. Writing as long ago as 1978, the Soviet dissident and survivor of the Gulag, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, said this: "The defense of individual rights has reached such extremes as to make society as a whole defenseless." It was 1978. It's time to defend not so much human rights. Bear in mind where he'd been. He'd been in the Gulag. It's time to defend not so much human rights as human obligations. Now, those two ways in which we think about rights leads to a third problem, which I think lawyers are extremely grateful for: the problem of litigiousness in human rights. You see, the possessive individualistic concept of rights panders to the pursuit of individual self-interest, which leads to an escalation of competing claims, expectations, and demands. And that gives us a problem. If you remember back to where we started, we want to use the concept of human rights to solve three problems: the problem of religious disagreement, the problem of arriving at common values, and the problem of holding governments to account. But this possessive individualist concept of rights turns out to be incompatible with the way in which Christian, Jewish, and Muslim faiths understand human beings and their obligations. The possessive individualist concept of rights may give us a common language with which to argue our corner, but it turns out not to give us a common language, or rather it may give us a common language, but it doesn't give us a set of common values when we're trying to navigate in our diverse society. What it ends up doing, if we have a possessive individualist concept of rights, is we end up presenting government with an overwhelming set of mutually inconsistent demands without any criteria for adjudicating between them. And these consequences of the possessive individualist concept of right lead to litigiousness, the juridification and the escalation of disputes and disagreements. Far from providing a commonly agreed moral framework for resolving claims, when we attempt to construct our system of laws on the basis of subjective individual rights, we simply increase conflict and undermine the ability of government to render just judgment or promote the common good. Because I think this language of human rights and the way we think about it creates two potentially misleading impressions. One is that legal rights are the be-all and end-all. The other is that the only things that really matter are me and my rights on the one hand, and government as the dispenser of rights on the other. So what I mean by that is, in any situation we find ourselves in, we know that we've got a trump card. If it all goes wrong, we'll play the rights card. And who do we ask to adjudicate as to whether our rights card is trumped? It's the government. So any situation we find ourselves in, whether it's at work or involving the scouts or wherever, I can always appeal to government. I can always escalate things. And so we simply find ourselves shouting at one another in a crowded society, demanding that our preferences, our choices, should receive the greatest possible legal protection and the largest available financial handouts. And so the rhetoric of human rights then becomes nothing more than a language in which to make Nietzschean demands in terms of the will to power. Put bluntly, if our conception of human rights is possessive and individualistic, they are nothing more than self-interested claims that my choices should be given priority. They are attempts at power grabs. And that renders other people in society my rivals. Social institutions exist to fulfill my needs. When they fail to do so, I appeal to the government or to the courts to vindicate my rights. So instead of finding our place in society through a series of mediating institutions, the Scouts, the Trade Union, the Political Party, the Bowling Club, the Rotary Club, the Church, whatever it is, we see these institutions as existing solely to fulfill our own ambitions. 50 years ago, political parties had members. As far as I can tell, political parties seem to have very few members now, other than those who wish to become the next MP. So everything exists, instead of being the network of places in which we find our place, these institutions exist to fulfill our ambitions, and when our expectations are disappointed, we sin. Well, I hope by now to have persuaded you of two things. The trouble is they appear to be contradictory. The first is that human rights are an attempt to address important questions about the nature of the society in which we want to live. You see, I, for one, want to live in a society in which government is held to account. I want to live in a society in which people who believe in God and people who don't can find common ground. And I want to live in a society in which no one is treated as subhuman because of their ethnicity, gender, religious beliefs, or any other characteristic. But the second thing I hope I've convinced you of by now is that the prevalent concept of rights, the one that we kind of reach for unthinkingly, is deeply problematic. So, shall we jettison it? Or is it possible to rethink it in a way which addresses some of those problems that we've identified? Perhaps the boldest attempt to rethink the concept of human rights comes from the American Christian philosopher Nicholas Walterstorff. He does it in a book called Justice, Rights, and Wrongs. I would recommend it as a central reading for everyone here. What he says is this: there are two fundamental dimensions to the moral order. On the one hand, there's how we act as an agent. And on the other hand, there's what is done to us, the things that happen to us, of which we are a recipient, or, to use a slightly older philosophical language, a patient. So we are both moral agents who do things and moral patients who have things done to us. What we do has moral significance, and what is done to us has moral significance. And here's the key thing. These two are not identical. In my former life, as a barrister, I used to do car crash cases. And I used to do car crash cases in the civil courts and car crash cases in the criminal courts. And what you discover, if you haven't already noticed from cycling around Cambridge, is that sometimes people drive really badly, and by the grace of God, no one gets seriously hurt. Lots of guilt, but not much harm. At other times, people make a momentary mistake. They step out between parked cars when somebody isn't paying attention because they're trying to change channel on the radio. And someone dies. When I was at school, before I came up to Cambridge, one of the people in my school was killed on the road outside the school, hit by a lorry while she was crossing the road. The other side of the school, the road, was a hospital, and it was her father who came out to deal with his daughter who'd been hit and wiped out by a 40-ton truck that just couldn't stop. Not much moral guilt on the driver. Bunch of teenagers running across the road, not paying attention. But irreparable harm. So, if we are going to capture not just the guilt that applies, but also the harm that happens, Walterstorff says, in order to do justice to the moral patients, the victims, we have to acknowledge that they have rights which have been violated. If we don't do that, we risk treating people as objects, not subjects. And we know where that leads. Terry Pratchett has Granny Weatherwax, a witch, say in one of his books, sin is treating people as things. I don't agree with much of Pratchett's worldview, but I think he's pretty much bang on there. So, Waterstaff says, we need an idea of rights in order to be able to recognize victims and treat human beings who have things done to them or who are vulnerable to having things done to them with full seriousness. But that does not mean that those rights that they have are things in themselves. So for Waterstaff, a right is not a thing. It is a form of normative social relationship. A right is always a right with regard to someone. A right describes a particular aspect of a relationship between two people. A situation in which A owes a duty to B and B has a right against A. So, for example, I'm under a duty to feed, clothe, and educate my son. My son, therefore, has a right as against me to be fed, clothed, and educated. It captures an aspect of our relationship. Now, Waterstaff also restricts the scope of rights by arguing that one's rights are limited to a particular subset of the goods that we might enjoy. The goods are being treated with appropriate respect and in accordance with our worth. So Waterstaff says rights are not possessions. They're not an answer to the question, what should I get, but to the question, how should I be treated by you? So he denies that the language of rights necessarily makes us individualists. Rights are not to be defined in the abstract. We need to think about them in relation to other people. The fact that we have relationships with one another gives rise to, or better still, carries with it a network of rights and obligations which we owe to one another. It's not his analogy, but the analogy I use when thinking about that is Waterstaff sees rights like that software that is pre-installed on your computer and which operates to help it in its network with other computers. I hope it works better than the software on the one computer I recently bought. Second way in which we might rethink rights. In popular thought, rights tend to be conceived of as absolute. Now, that obviously cannot be the case. In practice, rights have to be balanced against each other and against other interests and claims. The Catholic philosopher Jacques Maritain, who was influential in the rethinking that led to the UN Declaration on Human Rights and also subsequently to some of the work in recognizing the rights of religious freedom, which the Vatican had in Vatican II, he said this: if human rights were by their nature absolutely unconditional and exclusive of any limitation, obviously, any conflict between them would be irreconcilable. But who does not know, he wrote in 1966, but who does not know in reality that these rights, being human, are like everything human, subject to conditioning and limitation, at least as far as their exercise is concerned? That the various rights ascribed to human beings limit each other, particularly that the economic and social rights, the rights of man as a person involved in the life of a community, cannot be given room in human history without restricting to some extent the rights and freedoms of man as an individual person, is only normal. So there you see he's picking up not only on a challenge to the idea that rights are absolute, but also he's picking up again on an idea that rights are about relationships and sit within a relational context. Now, Waterstaff addresses this issue by insisting that we must see rights and responsibilities as two sides of the same coin. Those of you interested in the technical provenance of that, it's called Hofeld's correlativity principle. and I don't hold to it personally. But that's another story. I think we might have to go further than Waterstaff. I think an adequate rethinking of the concept of rights requires us to give priority to responsibilities. Now, let me do what Grotius did. Let me make that argument in two ways. There's a dispute amongst scholars about the extent to which the concept of rights is found in the Bible and in the writings of early and medieval scholars. But it seems to me there can be no doubt that Jewish and Christian ethics give priority to responsibilities. The point's made simply enough by the fact that both religions trace back to Moses at Sinai, not the declaration of the rights of the Israelites, but the Ten Commandments, a list of the people's obligations. You'll also be familiar, I trust, with the golden rule, do as you would be done by. Now, in Jesus' formulation of the golden rule, he makes it a proactive standard. It's not that we do unto others as they have done to us, but rather that we do unto others what we would wish them to do to us. So our responsibilities are placed before our rights. That appeal to those ancient texts doesn't convince you. Let me make a more contemporary anthropological argument. My observation of human beings, particularly within my own family, leads me to conclude that it comes pretty naturally to human beings to insist on their rights. What most of us need to learn in order to contribute usefully to society, to community, to our family, in our places of work, is our responsibilities. The chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks, has argued we've seen several generations since the 1960s brought up believing that responsibility is at best optional and most probably boring. This was his comment on the August riots of 2011, interestingly made at the safe distance of the Wall Street Journal. He wrote this: the rioters are the victims of the tsunami of wishful thinking that has washed across the West, saying that you can have sex without the responsibility of marriage, children without the responsibility of parenthood, social order without the responsibility of citizenship, liberty without the responsibility of morality, and self-esteem without the responsibility of work and earned achievement. Now, if he's even half right about that, we need to reorder our moral conceptions. It's not that we have rights and the corollary of those rights is that others have responsibilities towards us. It is that we have responsibilities towards others and those responsibilities entail rights. There's one more point I want to make. The proposal made so far addresses the vices of individualism and possessiveness, which prevent our concepts of rights from adequately addressing the issues it seeks to resolve. But what about that third problem, the culture of litigiousness which it produces? Well, I want to suggest that at root, our culture of litigiousness is a consequence of the way in which we try to invoke rights without having a theory of the good. If you want to see the impasses into which such an approach leads us, pick up Professor Michael Sandel's book Justice, or have a look online at his Harvard lectures, which are freely available on YouTube. What he says in those lectures and in that book is this: justice is inescapably judgmental. Whether we're talking about financial bailouts, surrogate motherhood, or same-sex marriage, affirmative action, or CEO pay, questions of justice are bound up with competing notions of honor and virtue, pride and recognition. Justice is not only about the right way to distribute things, it's also about the right way to value things. Sandel's point is simply this: when we're talking about justice, we cannot avoid talking about the good. So he says, we cannot work out how to regulate banking unless we work out what the good of banking is. Unless you know what banks are for, why we allow banks to operate, you can't begin to work out what the legal framework is that they need. Unless you know what marriage is for, you can't begin to work out whether same-sex marriage is a legitimate extension or somehow different from heterosexual marriage. If you can't decide what the free press is for, you can't begin to work out which version of the Royal Charter you ought to go for, or whether you ought to have a Royal Charter at all. The idea of saying, well, you know, people have got a right to privacy on the one hand, and the press has got a right because there's a right to free speech on the other hand, that doesn't tell you the answer to the question. You have to, somehow or other, engage in questions of the good to begin to answer those sort of problems. So what do? You do smuggle them in. So you're making the concept of the right do the work that an independent and frank discussion of the concept of the good would do. Well, that's sort of what we do. Or do we just shout at one another? So let me start that discussion about the good here and now by telling you about one particular concept of the good. It's one I suspect many people, both Christian and non-Christian, are not aware of. The Jewish-Christian idea of the good is the idea of shalom. And shalom is a state of wholeness and harmony within a community which exists when the relationships within that community are good. It's a good which is promoted by acts of justice and mercy, love and compassion. It's a good which is about each person being able to participate fully in the community, not a good in which each person is able to express themselves individually, regardless of cost to the community. I'm not going to sell that to you in one hit, but let's start talking about the extent to which that resonates with you, the extent to which you want to reject it or qualify it. We need, in our discourse, therefore, to recognize that we can't talk about rights without also talking about relationships. We can't talk about rights without also talking about responsibilities. And we can't talk about rights and expect them to do all the work when we're going to need a concept of the good to help us as well. So to conclude, I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We do need means of holding governments to account, of living together on what I suspect will continue to be a mixture of common values and areas where we agree to disagree. And perhaps above all, we need to hold firmly to the view that all human beings, regardless of their particular characteristics, especially the ones we despise or dislike, they are to be treated with dignity and respect. And it seems to me that the language of human rights is going to be part of the way in which we achieve those goals. But it's only going to help us get there if we rethink our concept of rights. And so we need to get away from thinking of rights as things which belong to me and learn to think instead primarily in terms of responsibilities. To think about rights as normative social relations and to be prepared to discuss and debate once again the question of the common good. Thank you. I'm hoping there are going to be lots of questions. What I'm going to do is collect a few and then have a go at answering some. There's a mic for those of you who need some assistance with the acoustics.
So, hi. Picking up from your last point, I'm wondering, like, this is rather like abstract question, but surely a right belonging to someone, although it looks like a property, is also a relation, because a right belonging to me means that, like, you can't infringe on that right without my permission. So I'm wondering where the property/relation distinction is really drawn on your view.
Thank you, that's helpful.
You mentioned that we need to sort of, as a society, figure out what fundamental values lie behind our institutions like banking or marriage, and from there work on how we use and view rights. What happens if societies can't agree on those values? What happens if they say, we have different ideas of what human rights are, about what our responsibilities are, and you can agree to disagree on some things, but what about those fundamental values?
This might escape the purview of your talk, but how do we negotiate rights in the context of a more international arena? That is, we're talking about what you strive as a society, as I take to be a nucleus. But much of our discussions revolve around the moral values or rights from, say, the Muslim world relative to the Western world, and there are meaningful consequences in between. And if we are to develop an international framework of rights, which seems increasingly necessary, how would that be negotiated in your calculus?
Thank you. I'll take just a few more. There's beginning to be a theme in some of these.
This may sound a bit cynical, but surely once you've rethought human rights as responsibilities, the full and status of the world would mean that people still wouldn't, they'd still think, oh, everyone has a responsibility to me.
How would you see the practical outworking of rethinking human rights? Would that be a change in the law? Do you think that the Human Rights Act should be rethought?
Thank you. I think lots of those questions all turn around the issue of culture. Let me deal with the first one first. Does this distinction between rights as property or rights as relations work? Well, you are correct to say that once I assert that something is a piece of property, I'm asserting a right in rem. I am saying I have this right as against the world. That's what's going on there. Now, lawyers, of course, are familiar with another idea about rights, which is rights in personam. And those have a much more sort of relational flavor. The area of law I now practice in, I've practiced in employment law for a long time, but the area of law I'm spending my time on at the moment is banking law. And what I see underlying the legal disputes there was a change in the way that banks approached dealing with their customers. They rebranded all their bank managers. They called them relationship managers. And the relationship manager used to deal with the customer in relationship with the customer. What's good for you is good for me. We will work together to achieve your goals. I will make money out of lending you money. You will make money because your business will prosper. Win-win banking. But then there came a point where the guy said, well, actually, I want to introduce you to somebody from the Treasury Department at the bank, and this is a trader who comes along. And this trader wants to make money at the expense of the customer. So the thing with the idea of a right as a piece of property is it tends to create a dynamic or a situation where my right is against you, something I can assert against you. Now, that's different from the flavor and connotations of having a right which is relational, where my right is in relation to you. One is a fundamentally kind of antagonistic, individualistic, atomizing approach. The other one is, okay, well, this is how you and I interact with one another. And that's quite a significant difference in terms of how we see these things. The next couple of questions are really about, it seems to me, is there, if we go deep down, Is there, if we go deep down, enough commonality to enable us to live together? You're asking, is there, if we go down enough deep down, enough commonality to enable us to live together within a particular society? And your question really is going to the sort of idea, is there enough commonality to enable us to live together on this planet with different cultures and different civilizations which work in different ways? And there are, of course, three possible answers to that. There's the answer which says no. There's an answer which says, yes, there is, but we don't know it. And there's an answer which says, yes, there is, and we know it. And so the postmodern mood might take you in the direction of, well, no, there isn't. The idea of natural law, which goes back as far as the Greek philosophers, you can find it in Islam, you can find it in Judaism, you can find it in Christianity, you can find it bits of it in Hinduism, and in various Chinese religions. That says, yes, there is, and we know it. That actually, there are some fairly important things on which we disagree. The status of women and how many wives you should have being one of the major ones, in my particular opinion. Whether you're entitled to have any slaves is another one that seems to me to be a pretty fundamental one. But parking those very important issues, there's a whole load of other stuff that the great moral codes of the world across time and history have in common, which at least enable us to get a conversation started. Now, I wonder whether actually at our particular cultural moment where we are at the moment, we're in danger of falling into that third category, whereby there may well be enough commonality, but we don't know it, because we've actually never really tried to have those kind of difficult conversations. And in part, our politicians don't teach us how to do it, because they sulk when Obama wants to, you know, give Medicare to people and just say, well, we're taking our toys away, we're not talking to you anymore. Or they, or we get a media which says, well, okay, we've got an important issue to debate. I know the way we're going to do it. The way we're going to do it is we're going to find the two most extreme people and stick them on and give them 3 minutes each to shout at each other, because that would clearly be the best way this morning of progressing debate amongst the educated public. You laugh, but I mean, frankly, the quality of some of the stuff we get on the Today programme is no better than what we get on the Jeremy Kyle show. You know, so we have a society where there are relatively few spaces where we go, right, okay, we've got a difficult issue here. We're coming at it from different places. Now, I think at that point, within our society, I'm really with John Rawls on this. I do think that an overlapping consensus is possible. That me, with my particular standpoint, and you with your particular standpoint, ought to be able to find some way of making it work and agreeing that there is enough in common to enable us to find a way of navigating through. Now, your issue within the international arena, I don't know that we can necessarily say we're going to find that overlapping consensus, because there are, as I've indicated, some fairly major issues. But I think the modern human rights movement was probably right in its approach, which was to go for a creeping consensus. So you get the agreement you can, and then you pressure. And what you tend to see is that governments want, whether it's they want the donor aid, or whether they want the respect, or whether they think they can pass the law and it won't make any difference in practice, what you tend to see is this sort of creeping development, where in most places the law tends to move in a direction. Now, that, unfortunately, in many, many cases, makes little difference on the ground, at least in the short and medium term, because the law is a dead letter, because you can buy the judges, or you can buy the police, or you can guarantee that the poor guy will never actually get around to suing. And one of my particular concerns as a lawyer is, what do we do? How do we get the laws that are on paper and working in practice? Because in most cases, many of the grievous human rights abuses are actually on paper illegal, even in the countries where they're being perpetrated. Then, what would I do? Would I change the law? I haven't forgotten your question, I'll come back to it. What would I do? Would I change the law? Let me go back to banking. When the crisis happened in 2008, we thought we had a technical problem. We thought we'd got the technical rules, and believe me, they are incredibly technical. The latest EU banking directive is 337 pages long, and it's full of calculations and formulae. We thought we'd got the rules wrong, and we thought if we got the rules right, if we made a few adjustments here and there, we'd sort the problem. And then we realized that some people had been behaving badly, and we thought we had a problem with individuals who were guilty. And then we had the LIBOR scandal and the swaps mis-selling scandal, which was on Panorama this week, and all the other scandals, PPI, mortgage mis-selling, there's a whole list of them out and waiting to come out. And we realized we didn't have individuals behaving badly. We had a culture behaving badly. In fact, we'd got to the point where people were prepared to send emails saying, will you please fix this for me? If you'll fix it for me, I'll buy you a bottle of champagne. And it didn't occur to them that it was a stupid idea or wrong to record it in an email, because everybody was doing it. Everybody was doing it. So what do? Do you change the law? Changing the law is not going to be enough. You actually have to change the culture. It's about what they teach in schools. It's about what you teach at home. That's where you start, it seems to me. We know about our responsibilities, in theory. We've got hundreds and hundreds of laws creating responsibilities for us. Far more laws creating responsibilities for us than there are acts creating rights for us. Lastly, would switching it round and emphasising responsibilities solve the problem? Wouldn't people just say, well, everybody's got a responsibility to me? Well, yeah, they would. Of course people would still do that. I'm a passionate believer in justice applying to everybody else. And when it comes to me, what I'm really interested in is mercy. I really want you all to be treated exactly as you deserve and no better. And I really, really am enormously grateful that my wife in particular does not treat me exactly as I deserve. Otherwise, our marriage wouldn't have lasted as long as it has. So yes, I don't think that switching it round is going to be the answer. But then part of what I wanted to say was that I think that one of the mistakes we have made is that we have assumed that human rights is the whole of the answer. And I don't think it ever was meant to be the whole of the answer. I think the idea of human rights was meant to be part of the toolkit, so that you have your moral compass, as politicians are fond of calling it. You have your moral framework. You have your way of seeing the world. I have my way of seeing the world. And we bring those things that overlap in part, and we bring human rights as a language, and we bring our understanding of responsibility and of the common good and what is good for us in our particular institutions and in places that we interact. And that is the toolkit that we use, and we use all those cards and we play all those cards and we talk things through and work things out. Human rights won't work on its own. We do need to get right in our heads what it is when we're thinking about them. Okay. I'll take another round.
Thank you, David. I just thought in the end, when you finished with the rethinking rights as the common good, a part of me was trying to figure out whether you were saying that as a lawyer or as a theologian, because I know that somehow the idea of human rights works, it seems to be like the intermediate solution in a fallen world. And the idea of the good seems to carry the notion of something that's in the future, the kind of eschatological sense, in which there's this idea that, you know, So we live in a fallen world, and this idea of the common good, I'm still thinking about it, so I think I'm still trying to frame my question. Can it work in a law, in a world where we need laws, you know, or the good can only be realized in a world where we go past the law and, you know, grace has to come into play? I don't know if my question has made sense, but I think I'm still trying to figure out how you made that link between rethinking rights and finishing on the common good.
I'll take a few questions and I'll answer the version of that question I want to answer.
David, could I ask a question? There are some who would respond to your vision of pursuit of the common good by saying, we've tried that as a culture in the past, and that's precisely what's led to the need for the articulation of human rights. So you think of kind of the, it's painting with broad brushes, but the kind of idea of the Christian Middle Ages, where we have this idea of the common good, and it's pursued in such a way that certain people are excluded from pursuing that. And so that leads on to my question. Do you have a worry? Well, the general question is, when you say we should pursue the common good, who is the we? Is it the state? Is it the local community you're a part of? Is it the lawyers? Who exactly should pursue the common good? Because that seems like it may be problematic if we think about that in the wrong way.
So I'm a Christian, and I think you're a Christian too, right?
Yeah, okay. Despite my PhD in theology, or maybe because of it, one of the two.
Because my question sort of depends on that, but as a Christian, I think that there's this problem of sin and basic human depravity in the world, and there's never been a perfect person or group of people or society, and so we can have all the ideas about human rights that we want, all the laws that we want, and we're still going to hit the same roadblocks because basically people suck. So can you talk about, if you're willing to go there, the need for God and or the Christian gospel to actually transform how we approach human rights and solve suffering in the world?
Any more, or am I going to have to deal with that lot? Okay. Who is the we? Well, I think the answer to the question, who is the we, is one of the things about being in the modern world is that we do have more than one set of relationships. You know, if you go back into the Middle Ages, you would probably meet in a year the number of people my daughter is in contact with every evening when she's on Facebook. You know, you would live in a village and there'd be 100 people in the village and that was it for your year, barring the one or two people who came in to peddle stuff. And you would probably work in the business your dad worked in. And you would be in a role that was there, and everything would kind of overlap and map. Whereas, of course, for modern people, we do this in the family, and we do that in the sports club, and we do that in the gym, and we do that in the workplace. And each of those ought to know what its common good is. Yeah, in some senses, I think some of the companies which have gone in for mission statements have been ahead of the game, provided their mission statement didn't say something simply as banal as we're in it to make more money. But those companies that actually sat down and thought about it, we're here to eliminate cancer. We're here to provide good value food. Each of those institutions has its own common good and works it out for itself. And it seems to me that the job of government, by and large, ought to be no more or no less than to allow individuals and those institutions to pursue those distinctive visions of the common good that they have. So you end up with a much more sort of liberal kind of approach to it than you might initially expect. I'm certainly not about to sign us all up for Plato's Republic. And that, it seems to me, also plays into the question about the relationship between the now and the future. Because, of course, one of the major things about which we disagree is about whether or not there is another life beyond this one, and if so, what its implications, if any, ought to be for the implications of answering that question ought to be on the here and now. And that, again, it seems to me, is not a question on which government ought to have a view. If you want to know, I've written at length about this. I think John Locke was right to simply say governments are very bad at deciding on what religion their people ought to follow, because governments tend to be interested in a whole load of stuff like, is this going to keep the peace and other bits and pieces, which is strictly speaking irrelevant to the question, which is there a God, and if so, what? Now that then, I think, takes me on to the question about people sucking. Yeah, I'd agree with you. Everybody does, but some people more than others. And, you know, one of the curiosities, one of the most difficult things, I think, to explain, if you have only one principle at work within your understanding of human being, is human beings are not as good as you would expect them to be if a natural instinct towards altruism was the overwhelming impulse in human beings. Nor are they as bad as you would expect them to be if an impulse towards selfishness was the overwhelming and irresistible instinct which they had. Nor, actually, do human beings consistently behave in the way they would if they were rational maximizers of their utility, as the economists would tell us that they are. There seems to be more than one thing going on in terms of what motivates human beings, and there are quite definitely more or less bad human beings and more or less bad human actions. And so whilst I would definitely want to affirm an absolute standard against which we have all fallen short, we need, and law does a very important job in grading the greys and working out at what point a grey is too black. Now that, I think, leaves me then asking, can this idea about the common good work in the present world? And I think it is one of the contributing factors towards the three big problems of possessiveness and individualism and litigiousness that I've identified, is that we have lost sight, by and large, collectively, of the idea there might be a life beyond this one. Because if there isn't a life beyond this one, you do need to get all your toys now. If there isn't a life beyond this one, you really do have to get absolutely everything now, because it will be game over. And if you haven't enjoyed them, there won't be any time to enjoy them in future. One of the claims that Christianity makes is that there was a guy who did have everything. He did have all the toys. And he came into this world from outside of it. And he didn't come into a palace and enjoy all the toys. He came into a stable. And he didn't wander around insisting on his rights as ruler of the world. He wandered around healing people and talking to people about how they ought to treat others and about their responsibilities. He gave up his rights, not least his right to a fair trial, and he was hanged. And Christianity claims, not just in that lovely moment at Christmas, which will finish off this term in Cambridge, but also in that festival that gets forgotten about because everybody's revising for their exams. But he didn't just die. He returned alive, which is pretty definitive proof, if true, that there is more than just this life. And therefore, you don't need to collect all the toys now and insist on all your rights all of the time. Well, thank you very much for listening. It's been a pleasure to return to Cambridge. We've about wrapped up our time. I hope you've enjoyed thinking about human rights. You're free to go. You now have the right to leave.